Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce that Schroders has become a sponsor and corporate partner of the Money Maze podcast. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. Thomas Jefferson, Marie Curie, Karl Marx, Jack Nicholas, and Queen Elizabeth II are some of the individuals that have featured on the world's banknotes. Countries have celebrated their heroes on their currencies, and first made in the 18th century from cotton paper, and now increasingly with polymer, the ubiquitous banknote has been an integral part of our lives. Bills, notes, wonga, cash, bucks, moolah, whatever you call it, cash has inspired two persistent forces: fascination and forgery. And in a world where money is not just changing hands, but changing shape as never before, it's appropriate on the Money Maze podcast to talk about the future of cash, counterfeiting, and authentication. And today I am the man who sits at the epicenter of those forces, the CEO of a 200-year-old company, and although only 49 himself, has been referred to as the best turnaround specialist you've never heard of. So Clive Vacher, CEO of De La Rue, a very warm welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Great to be here, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Well, let's start as we like to with your upbringing. Were you an ambitious child?
I grew up in the Oxford area, and although I came from a privileged family, my father actually ran a commercial printing company in Abingdon. He taught me, and my parents taught me, a number of things from a very early age that you have to work for things in your life. Nothing comes to you handed on a plate. And also the importance of hard work and integrity. And I think one of my childhood memories was wanting a little bit of extra cash my summer holidays as a teenager and being brought into work by my father and having to spend an 8-hour shift cleaning stray ink off the back of greeting cards, using this very powerful solvent that left me high as a kite at the end of the shift. So I think I got a lesson also in some health and safety that has improved considerably since then as well. But I think the main sort of lessons from my upbringing was that you really do have to work hard. And I think it served me very well right through my career. And I've really come full circle at this point, because having come from a family whose livelihood was derived from printing, I now have the privilege to run this iconic British company. And it is a privilege.
Right. Well, we're going to come to that. But we've had guests with all sorts of educations on the show. I think that you might be getting be on the top of the podium because you have studied at Columbia, MIT, Stanford, and the LSE, which is quite a roll call of institutions. Just tell me a little bit about the chronology and why so many.
One of my sort of mantras is never stop learning. And so I did the traditional university route in my young days at the LSE. And then, not knowing what to do, I ended up joining the police up in Lancashire.
That's a first for us.
And why would a guy from Oxford join the Lancashire Constabulary? And it was actually because the Lancashire Constabulary's eyesight requirement was much less stringent than any other force in the country. So, and I wasn't, my eyesight wasn't good. So I always chuckled to myself that if I was going to be a criminal, the best place to do it would have been Lancashire at those times. And I did 4 wonderful years in the police, and some of my strongest relationships to this day remain from that time. And that led me, however, to decide after 4 years for a career change. And again, with the adventurous spirit that I had, I wanted to go to the US to do an MBA, and that's how I ended up at MIT. And from MIT, I had an interest in aviation. I come from a family who's interested in aviation right across the board. And it was nothing more scientific about joining Pratt & Whitney than loving jet engines and thinking jet engines were cool. But Pratt & Whitney gave me my first foray into running industrial businesses, and in especially in turnarounds.
Now, I know you've held senior positions there at Rolls-Royce and BAE. How did your career unfold, and how was the learning that went on?
The first opportunity at Pratt & Whitney was to take a very high-profile role, not a particularly big part of the company, but the part of the company that was causing the biggest pain to our airline customers, and actually putting aircraft on the ground by lack of turbine airfoils. And so I had to fix that problem. And in doing so, we restored Pratt & Whitney's reputation, particularly with Boeing, who were threatening to exclude them from the next aircraft platform. And I think what that allowed me to do for the first time being thrown in that deep end was to really understand how to pull a business together to all work in the same direction. And there's really nothing more right through my career since then. I've always used that. A company with a very clear purpose and a singular vision of where it's going, surrounded by a bunch of people who believe in it, is what has carried me through a number of turnarounds in the companies you've mentioned, including Rolls-Royce, BE Aerospace, General Dynamics on the continent of Europe. And most recently, a semiconductor company that I was able to take private to the Chinese back in 2018.
So there might be lots of opportunities and a shortage of turnaround specialists in the post-COVID landscape, but you've obviously landed yourself an intriguing job, but it's different from the aerospace and the engineering businesses. So I suppose the first question I have is a tilt to a different profession. What persuaded you to join De La Rue?
Well, being brought up in the printing world, I'd always admired De La Rue from afar. And at the same time, throughout my career, I've always sought out bigger and bigger challenges in terms of turnarounds. And when I saw the De La Rue position, it fit perfectly because it was an area that, although I was previously mainly aerospace and defense, I knew one end of a printing press from another. But more importantly, I had seen the decline of the performance of De La Rue over a good number of years. And it was quite heartbreaking, really, because this company was always on a pedestal for me growing up. And so being able to throw my hat in the ring, to be able to come in and make a difference, was extremely exciting. And so I did.
So to set the stage, De La Rue has been around for 200 years. Its market cap today is 400 million. It's a member of the FTSE 250, and I think you've got about 2,000 employees. So although we're going to dive into the businesses, just give us the headline description of what you do today.
So we have 2 divisions in De La Rue. So we're a smaller entity than we used to be, where we had quite a broad range, but we are in 2 extremely exciting business areas. So our first area, our largest area, is the currency division. And in that, what we offer is far more than just printing banknotes, just printing money. We design more than a third of the world's banknotes, whether they're printed by us or by the countries themselves. We have a global presence and a customer base that numbers well over 100 countries. And for those countries, we produce, we're the only producer of polymer substrate that also is a banknote printer. So we are not only extremely well positioned by being extremely global, we have a broad portfolio of offerings, not just the print side of the equation, but also the substrate and the ever increasing security features that go onto the banknotes. And as a result, we are the world's number one commercial printer of banknotes. That's our first division. Our second division is rapidly growing. It's our authentication division. And the purpose of authentication is the protection and fight against illicit trade. It's the protection of legitimate trade and the fight against illicit trade, whether that's in the government sector or in the commercial sector. And we protect billions of products worldwide from counterfeiting. We protect government tax revenues, and we ensure that consumers have confidence that whatever they're buying and using is of the quality and safety that is required.
Well, thank you. That sets out your stall, so to speak. So let's start and dig into the future of cash. I suppose the accepted narrative is that cash is dying. Tell me about cash.
Well, I think the first surprise I'm going to give you today, Simon, is that if I was to tell you that cash continues to grow worldwide year on year and has done ever since the 1990s, I'm sure you will have an element of surprise to that, because what we see in front of us is a decline in the transactional use of cash. So there's a bit of a paradox there. So in order to understand that paradox, there's a number of different angles that I'd like to sort of share with you about cash. The first is we have to understand what it is, what it does, and what its purpose is in the world. We also need to understand the scale of it, the uses of it, and the macro environment in which it's transacted. So if we start with cash on its own, cash is the only physical way of transacting in the world, and it is ubiquitous, and it plays a pivotal role in society. So everybody is able to participate in cash. And if I was to tell you that 2.5 billion people in the world have no access to electronic payments, and most of those don't have access even to a bank account, you can start to see how important cash is. It's also the only free method of payment out there. So if you consider a banknote, it can be transacted thousands of times for zero cost. Every time a credit card is used, the cost of that transaction is about 1 to 3.5% that goes to various elements of the card issuance. And so when you add all of that cost up, the actual cost of electronic payments is way higher than the cost of using cash. And whether you use cash or not, the very fact that it is free provides a competitive balance and a competitive tension to the electronic payment methods and ensures that the cost of those remain low. And cash is actually more secure than any electronic payment. In the last year, there's about £1.2 billion worth of fraud related to card payments and electronic payments in the UK. The amount of counterfeited banknotes at face value total less than 5 million. So that's the first part. Cash plays a pivotal role in society. The second element of it is the scale of it. So there are about, we estimate, 620 billion banknotes out in the world. There are 170 billion produced annually. De La Rue produces between 6 and 7 billion banknotes per year. The majority of banknotes are produced by the states themselves. And of the 20 to 25 billion that are produced commercially, De La Rue produces 6 to 7 billion. And then what is cash used for? Well, everybody runs to the fact that cash is used as a transactional tool, and it is. But according to a recent Bank of England study, only 25% of sterling is actually transacted at any one time. 75% is the other use of cash, which is as wealth storage. And particularly in times when inflation is low, interest rates are low, so you get nothing from storing your cash in the bank. And particularly when currencies are weak, so when sterling weakens, the demand for sterling goes up. All of those factors mean that demand for cash remains alive and well. And it may be a further surprise for you to understand that over the course of the COVID pandemic, the demand for cash and the actual amount of cash in circulation has increased, not just in the UK, not just in Western Europe, but in the United States as well. And all of that is related to the safety net that cash provides in society. And then as a final category, there are macro features. Population of the world is growing rapidly. We're rapidly approaching 8 billion people in the world. By 2055, that will be 10 billion people in the world. And most of that population growth is in developing countries where the access to the electronic banking and banking facilities is less strong. In addition, banknotes provide a source of national identity and therefore need refreshing. And generally, we see countries refresh their banknotes every 7 to 12 years. And they also need refreshing to become more and more complex to fight the counterfeiters. So when you look at all of those factors and the fact that actually when we look at us, what's right in front of us in the developed world, it's only a small microcosm of what is really going on in the world. And for that reason, the future of cash remains bright. There has been no sign of a decline in the demand for cash, even though as a percent, in terms of transactions, it is declining rapidly against other forms of payment. What that means for us as a company and how we're positioned is excellent, because the other dynamic that is going on is that countries are moving from paper banknotes to polymer banknotes. There's only about 4% of the issued notes worldwide on polymer at the moment, and we are one of two polymer substrate providers in the world and the only one that manufactures banknotes. So the future of cash is bright, even though that sounds counterintuitive.
Yes, I suppose I'd read a fair amount to try and understand your particular forces that on the one hand, you've got a world moving towards digitalization, and on the other hand, you've got population growth. So I was more in the camp that perhaps it's like the tobacco companies that have a long pathway to decline. But what you're saying is actually the curve might look quite different and might still be ascending before we reach that point of inflection.
That's correct. And I'm not naive enough to say this is going to last forever. It continues to rise as we see. And in fact, demand right now as we speak is very buoyant in the currency division. But I'm not saying that that will go on forever. But what I am saying is that it will flatten out. And if it does decline, it will decline extremely slowly. And that will give us plenty of time to decide what to do and in which direction to take the company.
So I'm no scientist, so the question, which is probably a Luddite question, but explain to me why polymer and why obviously not everybody can do it in polymer.
Right. Well, paper is very well established and is still by far the majority, like I say, about 96% of the issued banknotes in the world and about 88% of the denominations in the world. And when you look at the Bank of England's study into their transition to polymer, they have concluded that polymer initially costs about 70% more to produce than paper banknotes. However, the lifetime of those polymer banknotes is 3 to 5 times and counting longer. So actually, the bank has concluded what they thought was that the transition from paper to polymer, which gives the banknote a lot more security, you know, much, much harder to counterfeit a polymer banknote. But the Bank of England initially thought that it would cost them a net of about 30 million. Their most recent study, based on their execution of the transition to polymer, has determined that it will save them over the 4 denominations, including the £50 that's coming out this year. It will save the Bank of England between 20 and 90 million pounds across the life. So first of all, you have a slightly larger upfront cost, which is a hurdle to get over for some countries. But then you have a much longer lasting, much more secure, much cleaner note. And so what we are doing at De La Rue, and because only two companies have so far invested in the production of polymer substrate, which is technologically quite challenging, we are encouraging softly the world to progress to polymer where appropriate. But we still remain and will continue to remain entirely committed to our customers that choose to remain on paper.
So that's a nice segue into the next part of the conversation, which is authentication and fraud. Now, we may have a video clip. Here's a £10 note that I have in front of me. I'm pretty sure it's made of polymer because it doesn't feel like paper. And I think it's Queen on one side. Is it Florence Nightingale on the other? Or have I?
Jane Austen.
Oh, my gosh. There's an immediate fail for me. So let's just start with the simple question, is that how does anybody know it's real?
Well, a banknote itself is incredibly complex. First of all, there's a window through the polymer. So that puts the people who use their photocopiers out of business, right? So, and it's very... You also will see that there's a foil stripe on the note that you can see from both sides through the window of the note. You will also see all sorts of print features. And since the transition to polymer, we have machine-readable features as well that are magnetic within the inks or have particular features that only a machine can recognize. And that can be used by banks with specific equipment. And at level three, at central bank level, when the notes return from circulation. So at every part of the system and with every note that we produce, we give the customer a huge menu of opportunity about the level of security on those banknotes.
So you write on your website, safeguarding revenue and reputation demands authentication and traceability solutions that are robust, adaptable, and can be quickly deployed. And I note that one of your activist investors have written in their own report, the company expanded its growth target for the authentication division and now aims to achieve revenue of 100 million by 21-22, up from 39 million in the financial year 2019, which is some pretty punchy growth. My words, not theirs. Let's just talk a little bit about how you stay ahead of the counterfeiters and what is it that you have been working on that is making it just tougher for the fraudsters?
Right. So I think here's where we draw a distinction and make the transition from our currency division, because all of the sort of anti-counterfeiting features of a banknote still remain in our currency division. And in authentication, we're talking about fighting illicit trade, whether that's commercially produced or government produced, and protecting tax revenues and consumer health. So let's start with the authentication division and why it's growing so fast. Well, the first reason it's growing so fast is because illicit trade is a $2.2 trillion business, according to the WTO. So every year, there's $2.2 trillion of illicit trade worldwide. If that was a nation, it would be the eighth biggest nation in the world by GDP. That's more than the entire annual output of a country like Brazil. So there is a massive problem. And with that illicit trade comes all sorts of other implications: illicit network, illicit activity, further illicit activity, health and well-being of citizens, lack of trust in what you are purchasing. De La Rue's authentication division is there to fight that illicit trade. And because it is so large, therein lies the opportunity for us. So what do we do? Well, we create trust networks. And how do we do that? We do it by tracing and tracking and securing products from the point of manufacture right through the supply chain to the point of use. And we do that in terms of any product that you can imagine. It's not just your high-end luxury goods or high-end sporting goods. It's other things like alcohol and tobacco and electronics, agricultural products, pharmaceuticals, the whole shooting match. And each one of those, the way you protect those is that you ensure that the point of origin is legitimate. You then ensure that that particular product is tracked right through until it is used. So it is probably another surprise to you to hear that De La Rue next year will produce 12 billion unique labels to authenticate products worldwide. And the majority of those products will be part of our digital system to track those products right through their life until they reach the user. So what does that do? It supports the rule of law. It supports legal trade. It makes it far harder for someone who's producing something illegally to get it into the supply chain. And it means that when the product arrives at its destination, there's trust between the consumer, the logistics, the manufacturer, and the suppliers that have made up that product. In addition, many of these products are subject to government tax, and we provide a system whereby governments can be absolutely sure of the quantities of products manufactured, imported, and sold to ensure that government tax revenues are protected. And that's especially important now at the time of COVID, when governments worldwide need to be raising tax revenues. All of that has meant that, together with other angles on this, like the World Health Organization's initiatives to stop illicit products for the health and well-being of global citizens, this all means that we have a very nice business in our authentication to ensure that those trust networks are put in place.
So the counterfeiters did not lock down. They have been at work. You know, clearly you have some smart technology here and you've been at it for a while, but you're up against some huge criminal networks. So how do you feel comfortable you can stay ahead?
The secret there lies in the partnerships with both the commercial entities and the governments. So any commercial entity, whether you're producing pharmaceuticals or electronics or luxury goods, and any governments who monitor the flow of products that are taxable, we all share the same interest. We all share the interest that we want legitimate product sold and we want to fight it illegitimate. And it is absolutely true that during COVID, a lot of the law enforcement has been compromised, whereas the counterfeiters have had a field day. And that's why I think you will see that that $2.2 trillion number will probably increase in the years to come. But what we have is a shared purpose. So where we pride ourselves is in the relationships that we build up with those companies and governments, such that they choose to use our products. And we are uniquely placed. There are many, many providers of pure digital solutions, and there are some providers of physical solutions. We have a wonderful mix of both physical and digital. And the physical is important because it gives a visual on the legitimacy of the product and the trust when it arrives at the consumer. The digital allows for absolute tracing and at every stage of the journey, the product to be tracked and stops the counterfeiters from coming in. So the secret lies in relationships, and that's why we feel we're extremely well positioned to continue to grow this side of the business, our authentication business, well into the future.
So there's a lot of conversation about vaccine passports, and that may or may not come to fruition. But sort of hypothetically, what's required to be able to make a system like that work?
So we are extremely interested in this subject, and we've publicly said that governments haven't made decisions on this yet. There are various ways that governments can have a solution to provide a vaccine passport. And I'm certainly not going to go into the ethics of it, which I think is one of the areas that governments are grappling with. But what we are able to provide, and what I think is the strongest solution, is this mix of physical and digital. So our solution, which we have offered to governments and we continue to offer to governments, would allow us to take what we already have in place for product and apply it to people in relation to the COVID certificates. So our vision would be that you would receive a physical certificate once you're vaccinated, and we'd have to play some catch up on that. But that your physical certificate was also tracked digitally, so you could put it on your mobile phone for those instances where that's sufficient security for getting onto an airplane or getting onto a cruise ship. We would then allow even border forces or airline check-in desks to be able to legitimize that certificate that you show. And right now, none of that is in place. I had my vaccine last week, and I got a small card with a label that was clearly printed on a black and white laser printer, and it would not be difficult to counterfeit that. So we would be able to provide an extremely secure document for those who aren't digitally plugged in, and there are many, and for those who would require it, perhaps at a border where the digital solution would not be sufficient. But we're able to link it to that digital solution so it can be verified at any point by anyone checking it. Because we are already at scale, because we already track and trace billions each year, we could put this in place very, very quickly. Now, that is our offering. Whether anyone will take it up, the jury's still out on that. And we're allowing governments to go through that process. All we can do is offer it. And I think it's a great solution, and we'll see.
Well, I suppose a cynic would say that no government has missed this opportunity of lockdown to increase their powers. Some would say in something of a unwelcome and insidious route, but perhaps certification and validation, there's a tailwind, an institutional tailwind behind you as well. But you don't have to comment on that. Just staying with your company, I had a little look. I think your historic operating margins have been about 12.5%. Clearly, the business has changed shape in many ways. What would you think might be the long-term operating margins you aspire to?
Well, we've made a commitment in that regard to our investors, and we did so before we raised capital last summer. And our commitment is once you took the base business, so we'd gone through a lot of turmoil, and there's no question that that was painful. And when you take out all of the discontinued business, which includes, unfortunately, the UK passports, we're a £350 million company. Our commitment over the 3 years up to, we're essentially a year into it, is delivering a mid-teen operating margin. And that will create an enormous amount of value. Back in October 2019, our share price was on the decline. And once we had had a really good look at the business and been open about where we really stood, actually in May of last year, our stock price was down below 40 pence. And the entire organization was worth £40 million. Today, it's worth 375 to 400 million as we stand today. And I think we have a good opportunity to create more value. And that's our commitment to the shareholders who backed us to help us out of a very sticky situation.
So I also read you have 1,000 patents. A lot of them may be of no use, but tell me a little bit about them and whether, in fact, taking a five-year view, you might consider yourself more of a technology company than a printing company?
Oh, I think we're absolutely a technology company. I think we've been a technology company for many, many years. Now, when we say a technology company, we're not Apple, we're not Microsoft, we're not that type of tech per se. What we have is an element of that type of tech within our track and trace system, which is extremely powerful, as we've described. But we have technology in every aspect of our business. So if we look at the currency business, there's technology that goes into every single banknote, and every year we release more and more. We have completely refreshed our paper security features portfolio over the last 12 to 18 months. We are releasing, as we speak, more and more features on the polymer substrate that make it very, very hard. And some of those features you cannot see with the naked eye, and they actually link electronically to systems within banks. So we are a technology company through and through. Now, what we are doing is we're becoming more of a digital company and more of a company that is tech in the traditional sense when we consider the growth rate of our authentication business. So although authentication is 20 to 25% of our business as we stand today, we expect that to grow and we expect currency to grow, but less strongly over the years. So we will see us become more and more digitized, more and more of a tech company. But we are an industrial company and we're a solutions company, first and foremost. And we use technology to reach those solutions.
Maybe it's apocryphal, but I read that you said turnarounds are generally pretty simple. And that made me pause because you and I were both at the LSE and I gave a talk to the LSE the other day. And I asked the students if they could name a company that in 1988 had 145,000 employees, 2/3 global market share, revenues of 16 billion, had been around for 100 years and no longer exists. I might ask you that as well, Clive. Any guesses?
tell me.
It's Eastman Kodak. Yeah. And so when you took on this role with your experience, have there been some times where you thought, maybe that statement about pretty simple turnarounds, you know, needs to be modified?
If I had my time again, I probably wouldn't have used that phrase. What I was trying to get across is that having done 4 or 5 turnarounds at this point, the characteristics in each of the turnaround situations are similar. There's a category of 5 or 6 things that a company gets into trouble with. And that's one of the things that I can bring to the table. I can go into a company and see what's going on and what are the aspects. So when I talk about that, the first thing is that being able to identify what it is that's changing that means your company is declining, right? And Kodak, a great example, right? Didn't realize the move towards digitization of photography. And that was a big macroeconomic, big external shift in their marketplace, and they were slow to respond. So that is one of the categories, and there's several others, including operational execution and self-inflicted wounds. But the first thing when I talked about turnarounds is that I do find it easy to go into a company and understand what has gone wrong and why. Now, when I talk about taking the methodology from there, once you understand what's gone wrong, the next is to harness the intelligence of the organization. And so what I don't do in a company, like you said, it's a different industry, and I've been in a couple of different industries. I'm not an industry expert. I don't have the answers. But what I'm able to do is to be able to harness the intelligence of the organization by bringing together a group of leaders who are determined to analyze the business frankly, openly, and without fear of any politics, and work together to find a solution. And we did that at De La Rue. It took us 3 months with 18 people, and we spent 12 hours a week during those 3 months together. They were the 18 key leaders of the business, and we dissected every element of the business, and we came out with a turnaround plan that we are executing today. And by having those 18 people establish the turnaround plan, go through that process, we have a unified vision here. And if there's anything that has changed in De La Rue since October 2019 to today, that one thing is that the company knows where it's going. And the 18 people who created that plan are the ones that are now executing it. There's nowhere to hide. There's no way to go off on a different tangent. We are all working together. And the results are showing.
So let's talk about activist shareholders. We had Sir Chris Hone recently on the show, which was a terrific opportunity. He's clearly been extremely successful in many ways, but as an activist shareholder, you've had Crystal Amber, who I think have close to a 15% stake in your company, and they've written about it, and that's what I was quoting early on. How uncomfortable, or actually how gratifying, is it to have an agitating shareholder?
Quite frankly, I haven't experienced it, because although Crystal Amber remains our largest shareholder, and Crystal Amber was extremely vocal a couple of years ago, I have had nothing but positive interactions with them and with Richard Bernstein. The way I would see an activist shareholder is really no different to the way I would see any other of our major shareholders. They are stakeholders who we have to involve. They're stakeholders who have to understand what we're doing. And they're stakeholders who have an input and who have a right to challenge what we're doing. Now, some people do it more vocally than others. But fundamentally, are you doing the right thing to take this company forward? And I think with Richard and myself, we have come to a great understanding. I talk to him frequently. We understand where each other go. I take his suggestions. I act on his suggestions. And I consider them. But I think the fundamental thing is, activist or non-activist, we have a responsibility to our shareholders to create the value that we've promised. And De La Rue has fallen short of that in the past. My philosophy is to build credibility a step at a time. So I'm not perhaps the most exciting CEO who wows people at every results announcement. What I want to be is quite boring. I want to be, I told you I'd go do this. The organization bought into doing this, and the organization went and executed it. And the more that we can do that, the more credibility we'll build up and the greater the value we will create.
So that brings me a little bit onto culture and ownership. How would you describe the culture you aspire to see permeate De La Rue, and how incentivized are employees, key employees, and yourself in being part of that journey?
Right. So culture is essential to this journey. And one of the most satisfying things about doing turnarounds is that usually I inherit a situation where people are quite despondent, where people have worked incredibly hard, but for some reason it's not working. So what I found when I came into De La Rue is it's the most capable company I've ever worked with. It's an absolute privilege and joy to be running this company. But culturally, it was despondent. When you work and you have all this capability, when you're the world leader, and yet the factors aren't working, it has an effect. Now, what did I do differently? I just really asked everyone, first of all, for complete transparency and openness. And I created an environment where it was safe to be that, because you never get to fix the issues without an honest assessment of where you are. And once you create that environment and culture where people can all contribute, and even though we had 18 people creating this turnaround plan, we had 2,200 people inputting into it. So everybody has a voice, and everybody. And then the other angle on it is that we made a commitment together that we would find a unified way through. Because in any organization where you've got a culture of some people thinking something's important, a different group of people thinking something else is important, you will not succeed. And so the culture now is vibrant. It's absolutely wonderful to be here. I love every minute of it. And it's because everyone knows what they're doing to contribute. The other thing that's exciting about Deliveroo is that we really have a strong purpose in the world. We support the rule of law. We support international trade. We fight illicit trading and we fight illicit activity. So people who come to work at Deliveroo really feel we have a purpose, and that purpose is very important and it's very global.
And did they get a chance to own the stock?
And in terms of stock, we actually have bonus schemes that allow stock ownership, the issuance of stock to leaders down to middle management. We allow every employee to participate in an employee share scheme. So every employee has the opportunity to buy Deliveroo stock at a discounted price. And we actually go down to first line management in terms of annual bonuses. So everyone is bought in. And if we succeed as a company, when we succeed as a company, all of our employees benefit.
I've got some general questions on your early journey, because you've reminded me that you're only 49, which is quite distressing. But tell me, what have been the largest obstacles and how did you overcome them?
The largest obstacle for me probably to overcome was I really didn't know what I wanted to do for many, many years. And I was quite worried about that in my younger years, but I told myself to keep exploring. And by keeping exploring, don't be afraid of a challenge. I took some jobs I really was not qualified for in my career. And some of them I succeeded very well with, some of them I was less successful with, but never stop exploring. And I think once I had got in my mind to overcome the obstacle of it's okay not to know exactly what you want to do, then you actually formulate it as you go along. And now I've landed on my feet in a wonderful company that I absolutely intend to stay long term.
That's great. Now, you said you come from a family of aviators. I understand that you actually have a helicopter license. If you had the opportunity and you could take a flight with two people you've never met, but you'd really like to meet, who would they be and where would you want to go?
I'm not sure with one of them whether I'd actually like to fly the helicopter, because I'd rather have dinner to really listen to it. But so let me tell you about him first. He's Alan Mulally. Alan Mulally was the former president of Boeing Commercial Airplanes and then went on to be the CEO of Ford. And the ticket to entry to our turnaround planning sessions for every one of those 18 leaders in Deliveroo was to read the book called American Icon by Bryce Hoffman, which is the story of how Alan Mulally saved Ford Motor Company, right down to the point at which he mortgaged the Blue Oval to save the company. And I am not ashamed to admit that I use a lot of Alan's methodology in running the company here at Deliveroo. We have talked extensively amongst that group of people about the parallels between what Ford went through and what we've gone through. And I haven't met Alan yet, but I do hope he's listening to this podcast, because he certainly dinners on me if he's prepared. And I'd be happy to go out to the west coast of the US to do so. So Alan would be the first. I think in a helicopter, it would be great to take David Attenborough and have us fly over some parts of Africa and Asia, because I have a passion for animals. And I think he is just the most fascinating person in terms of the planet and of the biggest crisis that my children will have to deal with, which is the climate crisis. And just to be able to have some time with David to understand in person his perspective on what the solutions has to be and the sacrifices that we have to make to turn this climate condition around, I think would be amazing.
Gosh, well, that's a great idea. Going back to Sir Chris Hoon, he's running this organization called Say on Climate, sayonclimate.org. And that's, you know, again, coming at it with a very similar motivation and determination and a large checkbook to ensure that this helps. Now, I've also been told that you have, I don't know whether it's awesome or outstanding, but it's an enormous collection of vinyl records, 5,000 LPs, including quite a few rarities and some music memorabilia. We've just had Merck Mercuri, artist of Hypnosis Songs Fund, and they have 57,000 back catalogues of some of the greats that we would know, like Blondie and B-52. Tell me your two favourite albums.
Well, I mean, my favourite album of all time is OK Computer by Radiohead, an Oxford band. They are by far my favourite band, and that is their absolute magnum opus, let's say. And I think from my collection, I have a Libertines album, of which they only produced 10. And so that's nice and rare, and one that I will keep for a long time.
Wow. Okay. So one of the questions we do ask our guests from that great book is if you could tell our listeners just one thing.
I would say never stop learning. And that's both in the educational arena. So as you can see, I mean, I graduated from Columbia University 3 years ago, and I was trying my hardest to blend in with the 22-year-olds at graduation. But I had great pride in the fact that I took my 8 and 9-year-old children to see their father graduate. So never stop learning, both academically, but also in life. The headmaster at my senior school always said to me, when you're faced with a choice in this world, always choose the most adventurous option. And to a large extent, I followed that advice.
I'm so busy writing down good pieces of advice here that I will be taking on myself and reiterating to my children should they care to listen. Okay, so I've got a couple of final questions. Stressful job, as many of our guests have. What does your ideal day consist of when you're not working?
Spending time with my children, who are now 11 and 12. I know it's a cliche, but being a parent eclipses any of what we've talked about. I'm sure everyone can relate to that. So certainly taking a helicopter out for a day is wonderful. Probably my best experience in a helicopter was flying under the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, which I didn't think you were allowed to do, but apparently you were, so I tried it.
And finally, what is your most important daily habit?
The most important daily habit that I have is to check in with my employees and particularly the leaders in the business. And the reason I say that is because it's not me who's making this turnaround happen. It's the leaders throughout the business and all of the employees. And I'm a great supporter of the notion that you've got to keep yourself fit and healthy before you can support others. The oxygen mask on the airplane analogy. And I think that it's therefore incredibly important that I'm supporting my leadership teams. And so the way I look at it is the pyramid in De La Rue is inverted, right? I'm not the boss giving the orders. I'm the boss supporting the organization. So therefore, checking in with leaders and employees throughout the business every day is a habit that I get into and enjoy doing.
So, Clive, we normally stop the show with a few of the pithy observations and lessons. The problem is there are rather too many I've written down. But I'm going to make a couple of conclusions. As you said a few minutes ago, I'm not the most exciting CEO. And, you know, that's really refreshing because I think that most of us would recognize we've been increasingly living in a world where publicity is essential, but competence is optional. So well done you for being so refreshingly modest. Secondly, I'm intrigued to know that the Lancashire Police Force have worse eyesight generally, because my co-founder of this, Will Campion, is a member of Birkdale. So should I be late for a round of golf, I will feel comfortable accelerating beyond the speed limit. Thirdly, the book that I'm going to read is American Icon, because you've said it's such a essential read and so interesting that Alan Mulally was, because it's a name I haven't heard of, you know, for ages, so absolutely essential and so extraordinary in your memory. And finally, great three words, never stop learning. I'm told that there's a photograph of you graduating from Colombo a few years ago, mingling and trying not to be too sort of evidently older than the rest. We might have to publish that when we release the show notes. I have learnt an enormous amount. This has been a real treat, Clive. Thank you for giving me so much time. I'm sure our listeners are going to not just recognise this is a really important and unexpected topic in terms of what is really going on beyond narrative, just what you're overseeing and how exciting that is. So thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Simon, and I've enjoyed the conversation greatly.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.